You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good afternoon. It is just after noon Eastern Time, and this is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I am Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter. I am trying to get to 10,000 followers by my next birthday, which is in just 2 weeks, February 21st. So go to Carl Frisch on Twitter and follow me. That's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H. We've got some breaking news here that just came out not long ago. Today, Karen Handel, Susan G. Komen for The Cure's controversial senior vice president for public policy, resigned in protest over the organization's decision to consider reinstating funding for cancer screenings at Planned Parenthood. Handel has been at the center of the firestorm surrounding the organization's unpopular decision to sever ties with Planned Parenthood, a decision that was reversed just a few days later following a massive backlash from supporters and its own employees. In her resignation letter, Handel openly acknowledges her integral role in formulating that policy that would have cut off Planned Parenthood's funding. And just a few days ago, just so people are clear, Komen founder and president Nancy Brinker claimed, let me just tell you for the record, that Karen did not have anything to do with this decision. So I think we still need to see the truth from Nancy, but this is great news for Planned Parenthood, people who believe in choice and a woman's right to her own destiny, and obviously a great victory for those that took action on this. It's another example of how impactful online movements can be, truly. And, you know, it's one of those things when this started just days ago, and it only took 3 days for folks to mobilize on Twitter and in the media and online to get this change to take place. And that's just remarkable. It's going to be a great show today. Like I said, I'm Carl Frisch. I'm filling in for Tom Hartman. We've got a lot of great topics I want to discuss. Joining me first today, I want to thank Eric Bollert for joining me. He is a senior fellow at my old home, Media Matters for America, the nation's most respected and largest progressive media watchdog. Eric, thanks for joining me.
Hey, how are you, Carl?
Doing well. So when I was at Media Matters, one of the things that we saw time and time again after Barack Obama was sworn in as president, and even a little bit during his campaign for president, was this notion perpetrated by right-wingers that Obama was going to get your guns. You know, it's gotten to the point that every holiday season since he's been in office, gun sales surge dramatically. And, you know, people like my father who, are gun enthusiasts, they can't tell you why. They're just sure. You know, my father says, you know, Obama's just going to sign an executive order taking guns away. And I look at him and I say, what would make you think that? You know, Democrats have not touched the gun issue in any real way in going on a decade.
Since Columbine.
Yeah, since Columbine. And, you know, with good political reason, I happen to probably be on the other side of the issue in large part, but they're afraid of losing Senate seats that they wouldn't have picked up if the gun issue were in play. Places like Montana and North Carolina, et cetera. So Democrats haven't even talked about the gun issue, no matter how important the issue might be. But Fox News has stoked this fear, hasn't it?
Fox News, it reminds me of the Fairness Doctrine, just like Democrats
right.
have never talked about. Virtually no Democrat on the leadership level has talked about the Fairness Doctrine in 20 years, but when Obama was elected, it was like that was going to be his first assignment was some sort of executive order and do away with the Fairness Doctrine. Same thing with the guns. Glenn Beck was huge because you have to remember Glenn Beck went on the air the first week Obama was inaugurated.
Right.
And, you know, before he had filled out his cabinet, you know, Glenn Beck aired a special. He was sort of mapping out war strategies in terms of which side the military would take when there was a civil war in the United States.
War that he was probably trying to help foster.
Yeah, whether the military would side with the White House and the Pentagon or they would take the side of those people rising in the streets. Literally, this was before Obama had filled
his
cabinet.
According to Beck, this is when Obama was building those FEMA death camps for conservatives, right?
He was doing a lot of fear-mongering in the fear chamber, as Shep Smith famously called it. And so, absolutely, Beck went early. He later dropped it. I don't know, out of pressure from other people or he just got bored with it. But one of his main hitting points very early on Obama's going to take your guns. Obama's going to take your guns. Obama is going to take your guns. Nothing to support it. As you mentioned, there's been no, for better or for worse, there's been no political action from the Democratic Party on guns in a decade. But who else has been pushing it? The NRA, of course. I mean,
of course. Well, yeah.
This is their fundraising. This is their shtick. This is how they stay in business.
Well, they even claim that that program that started under the Bush administration, the name escapes me, you'll probably remember it, Fast and Furious?
Yeah, right, sure.
Was an Obama plot to create a crisis to take guns away.
Right.
I mean, they won't let anything go without claiming this.
And they can't exist. It's sort of like, how does Brent Bozell stay in business with
right.
Media research? So there has to be this this liberal media bias menace. And if there's not, you know, there goes his $400,000 a year job. Same with the head of the NRA and those folks. They have to, you know, hit this rhetoric over and over again. The Democrats are going to take your guns. Nothing. They can point to nothing. But again, look, this is part of that. This is part of that right-wing parallel universe. It's not just gun control and fairness doctrine. You name the issue, they have created this bubble where they really do live in a parallel universe, and they just repeat this stuff over and over, and the people who watch Fox and listen to Limbaugh are in heated agreement that all
exactly.
This stuff is true. So
it's maddening.
It's maddening, and it doesn't have to match reality, but this is this whole... It's an infrastructure, it's a media bubble, it's a business model. All these people are making lots and lots of money just sort of peddling the same thing over and over. But every now and then something sort of punctures it, which is what Media Matters recently wrote about, which is Fox, of all places, found itself on the wrong end of the gun debate.
Right.
And they were accused of chilling the rights of gun owners because Fox Sports has this deal, a 7-year TV deal with Ultimate Fighting, and which is in the past, you know, the cage matches, with,
sure.
You know, the bloody matches and everything. It's become a huge deal on TV. And in the past, they've had gun advertising, and they've done really well, and that hits their market, and that hits their niche. And it was reported that Fox News told them, look, you know, we're not doing gun ads on Fox Sports. And the Ultimate Fighting confirmed that. And so suddenly on some of these right-wing forums, we're seeing Fox Sports is being condemned as apparently part of this, you know, Obama conspiracy to take away your guns or at the least not let people advertise their guns.
Well, you know, I don't know what they would call this. You know, when Palin was attacked by, you know, I think it was the Family Guy on Fox Broadcasting Company.
That's right.
She said, oh, it's not Fox. That's Fox Hollywood.
Right.
What do you think she would call Fox Sports?
Fox Sports. That's a little less easy to sort of dismiss as Hollywood, because every now and then Simpsons takes a swipe at Fox News. Fox Sports, I think, is a little different. I think it's seen as sort of level-headed, and you know, they're synonymous with the NFL and all the, you know, the weekend jocks and everything. So it's not quite so easy to just sort of dismiss them as some, you know, some sort of Hollywood screenwriters. But you know, they took the obvious. Nobody advertises, you know, NBC Sports doesn't advertise guns. You can't, you know, there are still parameters within sort of mainstream media and mainstream culture. And one of them is, you know, you don't advertise guns on Saturday afternoon to kids watching TV. But again, if you go into Free Republic and the right-wing forums, it's pretty funny to see, you know, part of the Murdoch empire.
It's fascinating, Eric. I want to talk a little bit more with you after the break about
sure.
This. And the latest in the Murdoch Empire phone hacking scandal. This is the Tom Hartman Program. We're talking to Eric Bullard. We want to hear from you, 866-987-TOM. We'll be back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, the Murdoch Empire hits the hacking trifecta.
Oh yeah, they're selling propaganda and pretending it's fact. Must be a Fox News with those right-wing views. Yeah, they're trying to convince ya the rich should get rich.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today. This afternoon, I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. Again, help me get to 10,000 Twitter followers. Hit me up at Carl Frisch on Twitter. We've got Jason in Los Angeles. Jason.
Hey, Carl. How are you?
I'm well.
Good. Hey, so I just want to reiterate, I actually was at Fox Sports for 6 years, and believe it or not, a lot of the people that work there are not conservative.
Oh, it doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
Majority of the people there are pretty liberal-headed and do complain about some of the stuff that regular Fox does.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, one of the things that we saw even, you know, at MSNBC when Don Imus made his racist and sexist remarks was outrage all over the gambit within NBC Universal, and that's ultimately what led to his firing. Eric, obviously there's going to be a difference of views among Fox News employees, and in this kind of economy, who can blame anybody for keeping a job? But it's becoming harder and harder to stay in a jail if you work for News Corp, isn't it?
In terms of the phone hacking, yeah. I mean, it's been, what are we on, like month 7 now? I mean, this broke last July. It broke big. I mean, it had been a problem in the UK for a couple of years, drip, drip, drip of a cover-up
right.
And phone hacking. And it went really big last summer, and we just continue to see more advancements in the story. And
well, I guess last week you had Republican Congressman Peter King of New York, along with a slew of Democrats, asking the FBI to investigate News Corp for potential hacking of 9/11 victims' families. And I guess that investigation is ongoing. But now we've got some news about email hacking?
Well, yeah, there was a report out of the UK that not only had the hacking spread beyond the tabloids, you know, News of the World and The Sun, which, you know, the tabloids in London sort of have a history of the dark arts. And that stuff is sort of seen as slightly acceptable. The report was the Scotland Yard was investigating the Times of London, which is, you know, supposed
that's
to be,
like a, you know, for people that would compare it in the States, it's kind of like the New York Times.
Yeah, it used to be before Murdoch bought
of course,
it, sadly,
yeah.
15 years ago or so, and he did to it what he's doing to the Wall Street Journal, which is sort of dumb it down and shorten the stories and give it a slightly partisan flavor in the news hole. But the Scotland Yard has confirmed that it was investigating the Times of London for email hacking and whether one of its reporters, in terms of doing his work, got unauthorized access to an email account. So, A, it's a big deal.
And let's be clear. This is not like the hacking of Syrian government employees' email addresses, where apparently a whole slew of them had the password 12345. This was like legit a legit problem.
Yeah, right. I mean, unauthorized access to someone's email account is a big deal, and that means you're poking around as a reporter somewhere you're not. And if you take a step back, A, it's the investigation spreading to the Murdoch's, quote, you know, serious press, and B, if you take a step back, so that's email hacking that's being investigated for News Corp. News Corp is being investigated for phone hacking, and in the United States, News Corp is being investigated for computer hacking. A marketing firm in the United States a couple years ago admitted
right.
Computers were used to hack into a password-protected website of a competitor where, information was stolen.
And there was a settlement in that case, wasn't there?
Big settlements. This company, News America, a marketing firm, well, they do sort of grocery store couponing and things like that.
Yeah.
They've settled 3 lawsuits worth almost $700 million. This was before the UK story broke big and not a lot of people paid attention to it. The Department of Justice is now going back and saying, well, wait a minute, is there a pattern here of unethical behavior, of anti-business, behavior, between News Corp in the United States and maybe in the UK? Because remember, Murdoch moved the headquarters of News Corp to New York City.
Right.
It is an American company, and the Department of Justice has every right to look at what its pattern of behavior has been.
Well, and they really should. I mean, far from a content perspective, as a journalist, this is just a lot of shortcuts that belie the argument that journalism is not taken seriously by News Corp.
It does. Two things. It suggests that journalism is sort of a catch-as-catch-can, and you sort of make up the rules as you go. But probably more importantly, it just sort of confirms the sort of culture of corruption that absolutely runs from the top down at News Corp. And you add to what we've talked about, you can go to Australia, and there were recent hearings in Parliament, and we got news from an editor in Australia who was told, who told a firsthand account on how he was approached by Murdoch in terms of there was an important telecommunications vote, and he wanted his newspaper to this was a member of Parliament down there.
Right.
And he was approached by an editor, a Murdoch editor, and said, we want, Murdoch needs you to vote for this telecommunications bill. If you do it, we will give you good press. That
or
is just
conversely,
sort of old-fashioned,
I mean,
quid pro quo.
To a politician, the converse of that is if you don't.
Yeah, right.
We can make life very difficult.
And the idea that, you know, this media mogul is using his newspapers as sort of a whip, you know, counting votes in Parliament. I mean, that is just, it's,
well, you know,
it's
a throwback to an era that we haven't seen since pre-World War II, you know, when we went to more objective journalism.
Yeah, and even then, I mean, if you think back to, you know, the Citizen Kane and what they were depicting, even then, you know, those newspapers, that was one or two newspapers somebody owned, and that was a newspaper within a city that already had seven. What Murdoch is doing is on a much more on a national and global scale,
sure.
and cutting the corners in a, I think, in a much more dangerous way.
Well, if you want to keep following these stories, go follow Eric Bollert on Twitter at Eric Bollert and sign up for emails at MediaMatters.org. Eric Bollert, thanks for joining me today.
Sure. Talk to you soon, Carl.
Absolutely. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom all afternoon. I am Carl Frisch, and we will be back in just a minute.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, You Betcha, we're talking about Santorum in Minnesota. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom this afternoon, I am Carl Frisch. It's 34 after. It's going to be a big day of news. You've got a couple elections going on for the Republican nomination. You've got a caucus in Colorado and a caucus in Minnesota. You betcha they're going to caucus the heck out of it there in Minnesota. Santorum could be a big surprise. I was thinking of wearing a sweater vest today in tribute to him, but then I looked at myself in a mirror and thought, no, thank you. We'll see. I mean, if Santorum wins, and I really hope he does, because I want this crazy train to continue all the way to the convention. So we'll be watching that closely. And then in just about 30 minutes, we're expecting the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to make its verdict known on the Proposition 8 case in California, the same-sex marriage equality case, which we're hoping will go the right way and state that California's Prop 8 was unconstitutional. We'll be joined later this afternoon with Chris Geithner from Metro Weekly. He's the senior political editor there to discuss whatever it is that the Ninth Circuit decides. So we look forward to that. Scott in Pittsburgh.
Hi, Carl.
Hello.
Yes, can you hear me?
I sure can.
Yeah, I was also thinking about making a sweater vest, Rick Santorum, but I would have his definition underneath his name.
Yeah, and you don't really want to walk out of the house with that kind of thing on.
That's true, but you know, just for my own amusement. But I'm calling today about Rick Santorum and the state of Colorado. Yesterday he was in Colorado,
sure,
at an energy summit with the Colorado Schools of Mines. He was the guest speaker on Monday.
Yes.
And he said, we are put here on this earth as creatures of God to have dominion over the earth, to use it wisely and steward it wisely, but for our benefit, not for the earth's benefit.
Oh, so, man. That Rick Santorum.
You know, that's, I just had a comment. I put that up on the Facebook, my
sure.
Facebook page, and I said, I'm sorry, Rick. You know, according to my theological upbringing, I happen to be an ex-monk. And dominion over the earth does not mean that we own it. we can use it, and we can rape it for our own sense gratification. It means the earth is God's property, and we are charged with protecting it in the service of God, not for our own selfish interest.
Well, you know, if Rick Santorum heard you say that, he'd probably say that if the earth is raped, then we have to make the best of a bad situation and keep the baby. And I guess the baby in this case is climate change. And, you know, it's sad to watch, especially in the West, these Republicans campaigning and denying simple facts, simple scientific, facts that climate change is real, that we have something to do with it, a great deal to do with it, really. And that we need to do something about it. And it doesn't stop there with these numbskulls. You know, it's symptomatic. They deny global warming. They deny evolution. They deny simple things that we should take for granted at a certain point. I'm surprised that they're not advocating a change to maps and globes to make them into flat cubes. It's that sad. But that being said, this is who the Republicans are about to pick in Minnesota. And potentially in Colorado. I've got this report from Huffington Post, Mark Blumenthal, one of my favorite pollsters, also known as Mystery Pollster. And he says, on Tuesday, Republicans will attend precinct caucuses in Minnesota and Colorado and vote in a non-binding primary in Missouri, of which Santorum is leading, but he's not on the ballot, which is great for him, great for us. And the polls look bad for Romney. He's neck and neck in Colorado. He's way behind in Minnesota. And he's way behind in Missouri. So the idea that we've heard over the last 2 days from Romney, people like Governor John Sununu, who I've talked to on this program, they keep on saying that the reason that voter turnout is so low, if you go to thinkprogress.org, they've got some maps up showing that turnout is down in New Hampshire. It's down in Florida. It's down in Nevada. Everywhere that Romney has won, he claims, the Romney camp claims, that turnout is down because Republicans are comfortable with him as their nominee, and they feel no need to show up and vote. It's the most ridiculous attempt at spin I have ever heard. When polling really shows that two-thirds, sometimes three-quarters of Republican voters want somebody else other than Romney, and that's why he could potentially lose two states tonight. It's quite sad when you think about it, but this is the world that we're living in, and it's great to watch. The rest of this country, state by state, is getting to see just how crazy these people are. I like to say, you know, the Republican Party is getting to know Newt Gingrich the way that Democrats knew him in the 90s. As Peggy Noonan said, he's an angry little attack muffin, and I'm glad that he's up on that stage with Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum every single day. Let's take Laura in Oregon. Laura.
Yes, Carl.
Hello.
Trosh Blanc here, and I have a question. I want to make a comment, though. We are of the earth. We are of the earth. So
yes.
Let's stop separating ourselves. Everything we need comes from the four basic elements. So.
Well, you know, if we separate ourselves, it becomes a lot easier to not care about the environment, which is why Republicans seem to see it that way.
Yeah, well, we are the environment. Once we realize that, well, then maybe we'll treat ourselves better.
Sure.
My question is, I watched MSNBC and Free Speech all day yesterday hoping to hear anything that happened outside of the Super Bowl on
right.
Sunday. And I haven't heard a thing, so I was hoping you or one of your viewers or listeners could educate me on what might have been going on out there.
Well, I think the big problem for the Occupy folks, and, you know, I'm a fan, it's really hard to compete for media coverage with the Super Bowl. You've got 111 million people, 111.8 million people that watched the game, 120 some odd million people that watched Madonna's halftime show, and folks wanted to compete with that for coverage. I think it's good that they were there to make a point, but I didn't see any coverage. I'm sure if you went online and Googled around, you'd see some photos and video, et cetera. But in order to get a crowd that could beat what was attending, you know, in Indianapolis for the Super Bowl, and then also compete for media, would have been a tremendous, difficult task to pull off. So I'm not surprised there wasn't a lot of coverage, if any, of what happened. But let's be clear. Occupy is shifting in direction, I think, with all these encampments being broken up and raided. And we'll be talking a little bit later in the next hour to Tina Dupuy, who wrote a great piece about Occupy. And she's been to the Occupy installations in 8 cities around the country and in Canada as well. So she's got a unique take on it. But, yeah, you didn't see much coverage because how are you going to compete with the Super Bowl ads, two great teams, a Madonna halftime show for coverage? It's just not going to happen. Nothing can break through that ether or that blockade. Let's see here. Let's take Patricia in Sacramento.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call today.
Absolutely.
I wanted to get a different perspective because I consider myself a progressive liberal, and this
sure.
is where I disagree. I see a slight difference between Mitt Romney and President Obama, but I want to give an example why I think this. The other day, I think it was yesterday on Bloomberg News,
sure.
I wanted to quote, President Obama said he is citing Iran freezing their assets because of deceptive practices of the Iranian Central Bank and unacceptable risk to the international financial system. I don't remember J.P. Morgan and Bank of America and Wells Fargo being Iranian. You know, it's hypocritical. He had pointed banksters to be his advisors.
Sure.
People from Goldman Sachs,
Citibank. Patricia, I don't disagree with you in the slightest.
I'm just finding
hang on a second.
He has done some good things.
I don't disagree with you in the slightest bit that Democrats in general and this president in particular have been too soft when it comes to corporations. Hopefully, this new bureau can do something about it once it gets its sea legs. But I don't disagree with that in the slightest. But to say that there's little difference between Romney and Obama, I hope you're talking about this issue in particular and not more broadly.
No, I mean, I think when it comes to environmental issues, I think Obama definitely deserves some credit. Maybe I didn't mean it that way, but I'm just saying I think a lot of us...
Issue after issue after issue, there's such a big difference. Even when it comes to corporate stuff, I will freely admit that since the mid-1990s, Democrats have become a more and more corporatized party. It's one of the reasons that they get so much money from corporations now when they didn't used to get much at all. But even on corporate issues, there's a reason that corporate America is backing Mitt Romney and not President Obama, because Romney will give them everything they want, and the president just won't do that. But then you go down the list, whether it's the environment, whether it's civil rights, whether it's jobs, all of those issues.
Okay, now, civil rights. Obama signed. He blatantly looked at the screen and said, I will not sign the National Defense Authorization
that's a civil,
Act. And then
ma'am,
he signed it. Now, I know there were bills
that's
attached
a,
to it.
That's a civil liberties issue. It's a little bit different than a civil rights issue. But you're never going to be 100% happy with any president. But to claim that Romney is very little different than Obama is just not true on issue after issue after issue. And sure, I'm not happy about everything he's done, but come on, he's not the same as Romney. And that kind of thinking really needs to be examined. This is the Tom Hartman Program. I'm happy to be here all afternoon filling in for Tom. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. We want to hear from you. Give us a call toll-free, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. When we come back, we'll be talking to Tina Dupuy.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More about Santorum. Don't Google it. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. I'll be here all afternoon. It is 50 past, and I got to tell you, this Santorum thing, I am fascinated that he's even capable of pulling off the win in Iowa, let alone potentially Minnesota today. Let's take a call. Denver in Nashville. I know it sounds confusing. It's not Nashville in Denver. It's Denver in Nashville. Hello, Denver.
Right, this Denver, Carl. I'm calling you from Nashville.
Yes.
Red state.
Yes.
Big time. Nevertheless, what I was calling you is I want to give kudos to that former priest who was talking about us having dominion over the earth.
Yes.
The Bible does give us dominion over the earth, but we've raped this earth and use carbon and fossil fuels to the point now to where I agree with many of my scientist friends that if we stopped using carbon fuels today, this earth could not, or man, for that part, could not repair this earth. It looks like, unless Jesus returns real quick, we're in for an extinction of the human species.
I don't think that there's nothing we can do. I mean, this is you know, humankind has done many things to improve technology in this world, and I think that if we can actually put some policies in place that curb carbon emissions and figure out smart ways to reverse what's happening, I think we can go a long way. I'm not going to hold my breath on the alternative that you recommended, because I don't think that's happening anytime soon. Although, you know, if you listen to the right wingers, they say President Obama's the Antichrist. So you know what that means. It's only a matter of time before something happens. Let's take Vivian in Brooklyn.
Hi, I'm from Buffalo. I was calling because I wanted just to make a comment from
yes.
the young lady who called earlier and saying that there was no difference between Romney and Obama. The problem was is that when Obama took office, the things that he tried to put into place according to his plan, he kept getting knocked down. He kept getting things not being able to be passed. And as politics are, he had to start playing the game. And so, you know, he's not an autonomy. He can't just do things the way he wants to do. He has the Senate and the House, and they're going to be able to stop a lot of things that he wanted to do. So we have to look at that. If we, as citizens of this country, if we wanted to have some things put into place, then we have to also react.
More than that, though, don't you think? I think the president has maybe been too quick to try and compromise with Republicans, especially given the fact that they have not compromised with him once since he's been president. I think that means that he's needlessly moderated some of his policies when he could have stood firm. One of the things that I learned from watching President Bush was that people didn't have to agree with him, but they knew where he stood, and they respected that about him because he was not going to change his mind on the issues. I think the president would do better to stop triangulating with two sides of a triangle. Jim in Harrisville, Pennsylvania. Jim.
Yeah, I would like to say with the Republicans and the Democrats going on now, with the 99% and all the protests and stuff. Well, how can the Republicans actually have a chance of winning the election with the 99% if we all vote Democrat? And you have to be a millionaire to vote Republican.
Well, unfortunately, that doesn't work out that way. I mean, this is a country that elected George W. Bush once and a half, you know, with the help of the Supreme Court. And unfortunately, in the 99%, and I mean all of the 99%, is not going to turn out to vote. There are a lot of people in this country who struggle day to day thinking about how they're going to put, you know, to quote George Bush, put food on their family. They're worried about their rent. You know, they're worried about their debt. They're not listening to progressive talk radio and watching the news and reading the paper like you or me or our friends or family. They're consumed with survival. So it's not surprising that so many people don't vote, but they really need to because this is on the line. And there are a lot of people in the 99% that are going to vote Republican because they've been lied to for so long that, you know, if they vote Republican one day, they're going to be rich, so they better look out for their own interests. Meanwhile, middle income, you know, income has stagnated. People are not making more money. They haven't made more money since the 90s. The mid-90s, when Democrats were in control of the White House and things were looking good. So I fear that people will rest on their laurels and assume that because we've watched this crazy train Republican primary for the last what seems like 15 years, it's only been a couple months, that we're going to win this thing hands down. That's not going to be the case. This is going to be very close. It could be closer than the last election, and we need to be prepared for that because it's not going to be easy. Let's take Buck in Seattle.
Yes, Carl, you're doing a good job.
Thank you.
And I just
I contacted Barack Obama and Leon Panetta and Ron Paul.
Yes.
Asking the question, how many bases do we have in the world, United States military bases, and where are they? And I got no answer from Obama. And even though I know Leon Panetta personally, and he knew me very well, I got no answer from him either. Ron Paul, the next day, in his campaign, said there are 900 bases on 130 different countries.
Sure.
What the heck is that all about, Carl?
Well, I think military base is probably a very broad term. I would imagine that you can claim that that's anywhere that we have military personnel. And the fact that Ron Paul replied to you is not surprising. If you think about it in terms of scale, he's receiving far less mail than any of the other people that you listed. And, you know, frankly, he knows that his campaign for the presidency is going nowhere, so he has plenty of time to respond to letters. Of course, I'm making light of that. Now I'm going to get all the hate mail from the Paul bots. Go to carlfrisch.com, and you can send me your emails. But we'll be back in just a bit. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. And we'll be back with Tina Dupuy talking about Occupy and other issues.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. Go there, sign up for my email list. And as I said at the top of the show, I'm trying to reach 10,000 Twitter followers by my next birthday on February 21st. Go to Twitter and follow me at Carl Frisch, and we'll make it easy for me to get to that goal on my birthday. Wish me a happy birthday. Follow me. I'm excited that I'm filling in today, and I get to announce some breaking news just now. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California has ruled that California's Proposition 8, which put an anti-marriage equality position into the state constitution, has been ruled unconstitutional, which means that we're probably getting ready for a Supreme Court fight on the issue. And joining me later in the show at about 2:30 Eastern, in the next hour, we will be joined by Chris Geidner, who is the senior political editor at Metro Weekly, to discuss what exactly this ruling means and where we go from here. But joining me now to talk about some other issues that I find interesting and humorous at the same time is my good friend, the managing editor of Crooks and Liars. She is a syndicated columnist who you've probably seen on Currents, The Young Turks, and MSNBC, Tina Dupuy. Tina, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Carl.
So you're in California, and Prop 8 has now been ruled unconstitutional again.
Correct. It was one of those things where, you know, I mean, I just, minority rights should not be voted upon. I know that Chris Christie is a big proponent of desegregating the schools via the vote, but that's not how this should really roll. And one of the, you know, most eloquent advocates for equal rights that we've seen in a generation was written by Judge Walker. And this ruling this morning is just upholding what he had ruled earlier, that it is unconstitutional. So this is very exciting news.
Well, and it looks like it's on its way to the Supreme Court. Speaking of discrimination,
exactly.
And you know, outright racism, really. I don't know if you saw this commercial that Pete Hoekstra, the former congressman, he's running for Senate in Michigan against Debbie Stabenow, a great senator up there, who was one of the lead fighters to save the auto industry, which is now booming and helping Michigan's economy grow, and leading the fight for more jobs in this country, has this, I'm just going to say it, racist television ad that he's running in his campaign. If we can play that, Jacob.
Thank you, Michigan Senator Debbie Spendetnow. Debbie spends so much American money. You borrow more and more from us. Your economy gets very weak. Ours get very good. We take your jobs. Thank you, Debbie Spendetnow.
I think this race for U.S. Senate is between Debbie Spend It Now and Pete Spend It Not. I'm Pete Spend It Not Hoekstra, and I approve this message.
Oh, my goodness. I think this race for Senate in Michigan is between a champion for jobs and people of color and gays and lesbians and a bigot. What do you think, Tina?
He really calls himself Spend It Not.
Yeah.
Like,
and people were talking about the bad grammar that they gave to the caricature of a Chinese American.
Right, but it's between the Spend It Now and Spend It Not candidate. I saw that, and there was a pitch meeting. You know, someone was going over, they're like, okay, rice patties.
By the way, in a state that's struggling for jobs, that ad was filmed in Northern California.
Right, exactly. There were so many things, but it's like that this had to go through a committee, that there was a crew of people that were like, okay, this is a great idea. And then not only when it's in the can to look at it, then you decide to put it on television. So there are so many.
Do you think it was originally toned down when we were having the discussions with his hoaxers in there with his ad guy saying, okay, I like where you're going with this, but can we make it more racist-y?
Can we make her accent a little thicker? Because is she supposed to be Chinese? I didn't really get the whole, like, you know, our money comes to...
The thought put out there is that it's a woman in China. And, you know, just to show you the race baiting that happens on the right, Britt Hume from Fox News, the former head anchor there, who's still a contributor, tweeted out that he didn't know what the big hoopla over the ad was, because the woman in the ad had better English than most, he actually said 100% of Chinese Americans.
I wish he would have said Mexicans.
If he worked at MSNBC or CNN or ESPN or I'm guessing any television station on television, he would have been fired.
Yeah, I was going to say any legitimate news organization would fire him. Absolutely.
Talking about a legitimate news organization here.
Right. This is disgusting, but, you know, he's a Spend It Not who spent money on this. And so, yeah, this is.
And just to be clear, people listening at home or on Free Speech TV, that music that you heard at the beginning that sounded like, a caricature of Chinese music, we did not play that as part of the ad. It's actually part of the commercial.
Can I just say, before we move on to anything else, I think Spend It Not is actually bad English.
It is.
I don't think it's. The whole thing is.
But what do you expect from somebody who's from a party that denies evolution and climate change? They think that grammar, vocabulary, letters, numbers, shapes, and math have a liberal bias.
Right. No, it's weird to be anti-science with an iPhone in your pocket. I don't know. I don't get it.
Well, speaking of humor, and on the subject of religion, I think when you see that Mitt Romney talks so much about faith without really talking about his own faith or the pillars of his religion. I mean, we were all shocked that George W. Bush ran in 2000 talking so much about religion and faith because really they're presidents always talk about religion in some way or God in some way, but Bush really laid it on. And Romney does much the same thing, but he never really talks about his own faith. And I was startled when I saw the report that said that he and his family had, you know, baptized his dead father-in-law, who was a scientist and an atheist. Do you remember seeing that story?
Yes, I am familiar with that.
So I was delighted last week when Bill Maher unbaptized Mitt Romney's father-in-law. Let's hit the audio. If we can hit the audio. All right, we'll hit it in just a second.
We're just hitting that audio all over the place.
Well,
I mean, the thing that he does talk about, Romney talks about religious freedom, and he kind of gives like these, and for Mormons, like 100 years ago, if a Mormon talked about religious freedom, it would mean completely different thing than what
well,
he talks about now.
Wait, not just random that. Mormons, by the way.
Right.
We're talking about Romney's grandfather.
Right.
And for folks that don't know what we're talking about, Romney's grandfather moved his family to Mexico.
To avoid U.S. law.
To avoid laws about polygamy. And then he had his family, I think, airlifted back into the country.
Right. In 1911, Mexico, they were on the brink of a civil war, and so he basically, his family got a bailout from the U.S. government.
Which taught Romney an important lesson. When you're in trouble, get a bailout, just like he did for Bain. Tina, when we come back, we're actually going to play Bill Maher's unbaptizing of Mitt Romney's father-in-law, who is an atheist scientist and is probably literally spinning in his grave on a planet that is devoted to his Mormon new family. Tina, can you stick around?
I can.
All right, great. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom. I'm Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. We want to hear from you. Give us a call, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. And we'll take your calls after this break. We're going to be talking more with Tina Dupuy, not just about Mitt Romney's father-in-law's unbaptism, but also about where the Occupy movement goes from here. It's a very important question, given that the camps were just raided here in D.C. And that it's happening all over the country. We'll be back with more and those subjects after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, Bill Maher unbaptizes a Romney family member. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. We're joined by Tina Dupuy. If you're just joining us, to give you a backstory on this, it was reported recently that Mitt Romney's deceased father-in-law, that's his wife's father, obviously, who was a scientist and a devout atheist, was baptized posthumously as a Mormon. And Bill Maher had something to say about that. Let's play the Bill Maher clip.
If you still insist atheism is a religion, then it's only fair that we get to do all the loony stuff that you get to do. And I'm going to start tonight by unbaptizing Mitt Romney's dead father-in-law. For the late Edward Davies. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today in the presence of math, gravity, evolution, and electricity to honor Brother Edward and to send the powers of SEAL Team 666 to rescue him from planet Klolob so that he may spend eternity with the kind of free thinkers he chose to hang out with on Earth. So by the power granted to me by the Blair Witch, Schlemiel, Schlemazel, E Pluribus Mumbo Jumbo, Expecto Patronum, Susu Sudio, Yo Mama, I call upon the Mormon spirits to leave your body the f*** alone. Brother Edward, in this world you had to put up with Mitt Romney. You've suffered enough.
Tina, what do you make of that?
I think it's fantastic. I think that, Bill Maher has come out for atheism, and, you know, he can claim he's moving the dialogue forward in a Mickey Mouse hat from Fantasia.
It was pretty decent. If you haven't seen it, go Google it online. It's worth watching as well as listening to. And the reason I bring it up is because President Obama has been questioned about his faith from the time he stepped onto the national stage. And I think that it's only right. If you believe, as Mitt Romney's church does, that black people should not have been allowed into heaven until 1978, you deserve to be questioned about that and your opinions on that, especially when we see from his financial disclosures that he gave more in charity to the Mormon church than he paid in taxes. I think it's only right to start asking questions about these things. But, of course, he doesn't, because he understands that its base, the Republican Party, is bigoted, and evangelicals will be freaked out if they hear what Mormons actually believe. So he's got that going for him. This is a guy who can't even inspire his own base, and he's likely to have a long, drawn-out primary as a result. But one of the things that's complicated things on the national stage is the Occupy movement. You wrote a great piece for Alternet that people can find at tinadupuy.com talking about how the Occupy movement needs to stand up and castigate folks that would use violence or wreck property in their protests.
violence and vandalism.
Right.
And, you know, I wrote this last week, of course, and then over the weekend, Occupy Oakland threw a bottle of urine at a media van, which to me is another escalation. You know, that's just, it's disgusting.
Well, I mean, it's smart communication strategy, right? Take us seriously. Here's some urine on your van.
Right. Well, it's like, I mean, you know, the problem is that at, you know, at some point there, you know, this went viral right away. This wasn't something like the Tea Party where it was kind of like AstroTurf from the very beginning.
Right.
This is something that went viral and kind of just gangbusters overnight. And it went gangbusters because there were nonviolent protesters who were assaulted by the police for no apparent reason.
And nonviolent means you start the day nonviolent regardless of what the police do. You finish the day nonviolent.
Exactly. And I've talked to a lot of occupiers that say, you know, well, it's contingent on whether or not the police are going to be jerks to us. And it's like, okay, well, no, that's not actually nonviolent.
And what do they call it at the meetings? They call it an alternative.
Diversity of tactics.
Yeah.
To a liberal ear sounds like diversity of opinion or affirmative action. It sounds like something that, you know, we're welcoming.
And it's not, I want to hold a red sign, I want to hold a white sign.
Yeah, no, it's, I want to break windows because I'm angry. And I'm myopic and I don't have a long game or, and so I want to undercut anybody else's goals of actually having.
Well, and during, you're right, during the 1960s, Saul Alinsky, who, you know, the right claims is running Obama from the grave, he had something to say about the Weather Underground, those American terrorists during the civil rights struggle.
Yeah, he said that the Weather Underground, the terrorist wing of the pacifist movement, very odd. he said that they should be on the payroll of the establishment because they help the establishment anything more, or, you know, it, more than anything else. But I just think about, for example, I mean, because there's now there are voices within the Occupy movement that are like, maybe we should just be having European style riots. Now let's walk through what riots do. For an example, if the Rodney King riots,
sure. Right,
instead of having a riot, which, you know, that wasn't planned, that just kind of happened, and there were solidarity riots all over the country. Say that there were not riots, and instead there were 30,000 people who marched peacefully and sat on the steps of the LAPD central headquarters and demanded justice. That would have a much different effect than people getting beaten to death in the streets. There would not
absolutely. It's far more compelling to people that would never. It's far more compelling to people that would never go out and protest themselves. At least they can find solidarity in that. We've got about 40 seconds left, Tina. What's the next step for Occupy?
They need to do some soul searching. They need to find out if they want to be in solidarity with Oakland or be in solidarity with what they originally set out to do, which is to change the economic inequality in this country.
Well, they've certainly brought the issue to the forefront. Tina Dupuy, managing editor of Crooks and Liars, thanks for joining me. You can follow Tina Dupuy on Twitter at Tina, D-U-P-U-Y. You can also go to her website, tinadupuy.com, sign up for her emails and read her column every week. She's a great writer and a great reporter. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. We'll be here for the rest of the afternoon, and we'll be back after this.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the battle for the super PACs escalates.
Every day I'm shuffling.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. Be here all afternoon. It is 34 after. And you can find out more about me at carlfrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. Let's talk to Daily Dave in Hawaii. Dave.
Hey, hello.
Hello.
My issue is low information voters.
Yes.
How do we reach them? And I think the only way is to advertise or get some information to them on the shows they watch, like American Idol, Dancing with
sure.
the Stars.
Well, I mean, they, you know, low information voters, it really depends on the demographic you're looking for because it sweeps across everything you can think of, gender, age, race, et cetera. You can do advertising. You can do direct mail. online advertising is becoming more and more effective. In fact, a friend of mine launched a company recently where they can actually advertise to specific voters over the internet. It's quite fascinating. So the websites they use, you know, would be carrying ads from the candidate X or against candidate Y, whatever. But it's important. One of the most effective ways of doing it, obviously, is on the ground, which is why it's so important for people to get active within the process and not just sit at home on the computer or watching television. Of course, watching this show on Free Speech TV is perfectly fine, or listening to it on the radio. But getting out there and working the precinct and getting to know your neighbors and getting them to the polls is always, always imperative. Let's take Martin in Phoenix. Martin.
I'm so happy to be able to share this story with a national audience. Last week, on February 2nd, Arizona Representative Cecil Ash, who is Mitt Romney's former campaign treasurer for his 2008 presidential run, he wanted to pose the idea of a day for white people in Arizona.
Sorry, repeat that one more time. He wanted to do what?
Propose a day for in honor of white people. And this was in response. He was in a meeting with State Senator Richard Miranda, who I went to high school with. Richard Miranda comes from a very fine family of lawyers that have been active in Arizona politics. And he was proposing a day where we honor Hispanic leaders in Arizona.
Well, Arizona didn't even celebrate Martin Luther King Day until I think it was 2007.
Exactly. And but the very interesting thing about Cecil Ash is not only was he Mitt Romney's campaign chairperson or treasurer, but he was also a Mormon missionary in France at the same time Mitt Romney was.
Very interesting.
He's also extremely wealthy and has a home in New York City in addition to his home in Arizona.
Well, it sounds like he can have as many days as he wants. He can certainly afford it. Martin, would you mind going to carlfirsch.com and sending me any information you have on that story?
I will. And if I could just say one more thing.
Sure.
The people really need to educate themselves as to, can I park here or do I have to park out there?
Well, it's either North Phoenix or wherever.
I'm sorry. We gotta let you go, Martin. Thanks a lot for calling, and please go send that story to me because it's fascinating. I want to learn more about it. Let's take AC in Florida. AC.
Hey, how you doing, bro?
Good, thanks.
Hey, let me give a couple points to you and keep it simple for the people out there. And this is my best definition of how the right wing has perpetrated their power base since Reagan. And then we can, you know, you can go over that. And then I want to tell you where this road leads, obviously, if we go from Reagan to where we are now.
All right.
And look at that picture. Okay, first, the first thing they do is they successfully seduce the emotions of the people that they want to corral up.
Sure.
And they do it very well.
Well, it's certainly easy to do that when you're in a weak economy, or economy that's just barely recovering, getting stronger but barely recovering. It's not uncommon in times like this that people begin to blame other people for their position in life. And I don't mean specific people, like the people who are responsible for where they are. I mean people like African Americans. I mean people like young people. I mean people like Hispanics and immigrants. Look at the ad that we talked about that's airing in Michigan, Chinese folks. It's not uncommon for these people to be blamed because it's an easy outlet for emotions to be put on entire groups and swaths of people. It's what leads to the rise of people like Glenn Beck or Father Coughlin, if you take it back even further. But you're right. They do seduce the emotions, and they give somebody who feels powerless the opportunity to place blame and to fight against. And that's the sad, sick part of Republican tactics. They call it the Southern strategy, but really at this point it's the Republican strategy. It's the Fox News strategy, and it's not new by any stretch of the imagination. Let's take Mac in Colorado. Mac.
Hey, Carl.
Hello.
Hey, I'm glad to talk to you, man. I've never seen you. that thing that you said about Bill Maher, I watched that episode, and he clearly stated that he was an atheist.
Sure.
And I don't believe atheists don't have much of a voice in this country. You know, it's kind of like the right-wing religious groups are running amok.
Well, I don't mind if religious folks want to express the religion. It doesn't make me any less firmly, you know, in my beliefs. What I mind is when they try and legislate those beliefs or you know, impact the media to not do something that they find that is counter to their religious beliefs, whether it's the so-called million moms going against Ellen DeGeneres representing JCPenney's, or whether it's legislating their own biblical worldview. That's not what this country was founded for, no matter how much they try to distort our history.
Well, I understand, but if the right wing would really investigate Romney, I mean, does anybody really believe that Jerusalem is going to be in Missouri? I mean, well, I lived in Missouri, and anywhere that you go, I mean, I live in Colorado now. It's the most beautiful place.
Oh, sure. Anybody who wants to know about the Church of Latter-day Saints, and I know plenty of Latter-day Saints that are great, outstanding, upstanding people. But if you're interested in have an inkling to want to know more about different religions, I suggest you go watch the miniseries that PBS produced called The Mormons. I think it's an 8-part series. It's captivating. It's on Netflix. You can probably find it online as well. And you'll learn these types of things that are interesting about the Mormon Church, and certainly would be very interesting to the evangelical base of the Republican Party. Let's take Scott in California. Scott.
Hey, Carl. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to say that, you know, in listening to you today and Tom over time, I understand that all the money is going to the two major parties, but I want to let everyone know that if they don't know that there is another party called the Green Party of the United States.
I think people are very familiar with the Bush administration.
The Green Party of the United States is what I just said.
I know. I think people are very familiar with the Bush administration. When people voted.
Still blaming nations.
I'm not
for
still.
That.
You're bringing up the Green Party. I'm going to tell you what I think about it. And I'm not still blaming. He has blame to take. In 2000, he is the reason that George W. Bush was elected president. The numbers don't lie.
Yeah, besides what the New York Times ran in terms of Gore actually winning Florida anyway.
No, I don't doubt that for a minute, but had Nader not been on the ballot, it would have been even easier for Gore to win. I believe that Gore did win the election, but Ralph Nader certainly didn't make it any easier.
Can I get onto my point? So, you know, the reason why I can't vote for Obama or Romney, but Obama especially, is that while...
You're a Green Party member and you're saying, but Obama especially? So you would vote for Mitt Romney before you'd vote for Obama?
No, I wouldn't vote for either of those two. Romney obviously is an easy, you know, no-brainer, but with Obama...
But Obama especially is worse.
No, because as a senator, he voted for the continuation of the Patriot Act. He continued by his vote as a senator, following Bush's policies. And then after he's elected, he has not Bush cheating on himself.
I see your point that there are various things that I don't support that the president has done, but I'm not a purist, and I don't want my vote to be wasted. And I hope you realize that, yeah, you can go make yourself feel good by voting for somebody that probably stands firmly behind everything that you believe in. And watch those things. If Mitt Romney is elected, you can watch those things be hurt even more, because that's exactly what's going to happen. I hate to break it to folks, but third parties are just that. They're third parties. Once the invites go out to the two major parties, there's just not that many people to show up at your party. And on election day, you'll feel like you're in third grade and your parents invited everybody to a surprise party and nobody showed up, because people are not going to vote for your candidate. You'll feel good at the end of the day because you got to eat some cake, but you're not going to go anywhere from there. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. If you're a Green Partier or a Ron Paul supporter, you can send your hate mail right there to carlfrisch.com. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the super PACs exploding with news that the president is backing down on his opposition for Democrats to form and raise unlimited money. You'll be surprised by my perspective. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's an absolutely huge news day. More on that after this. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. We'll be with you till the end of this hour, and one more to go on this big news day with Minnesota and Colorado happening. Let's take John in Wayland, Michigan. John.
Yes, sir. How are you doing today, Carl?
Good, thanks, John.
Doing a good job, for
Thank
sure.
Thank you.
Say, as far as a question mark that I seem to have found an answer to, if people would look back in history in the past 31 years since Ronald Reagan started his tax cuts for the rich, and an answer to the question of who's done the better job with the economy, if people just stand back and look, in the last 31 years, Republicans have been in the White House for 20 of those years, and the Democrats have had 11, and of those 11, Bill Clinton had 8, and he left us with a surplus. So it would seem really easy to stand back and look at that and say, okay, who has done the better job?
Well, let's be honest, John. I mean, if Ronald Reagan rose from the grave and we weren't freaked out that he rose from the grave, like zombie Reagan didn't scare us, but if zombie Reagan ran for president in this Republican field, he would have had to drop out after the Iowa straw poll because he raised taxes 11 times. He signed abortion legislation in California. He dealt with hostage takers in Iran. He abandoned Marines. This is a guy who would be held up for ridicule in his current Republican Party that idolizes him as if he walks on water.
A lot of people seem to think that, too.
Well, but, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that facts get in the way of a Republican argument, should we? Because it is the Republican Party, after all. Let's take Paula in Arkansas. Paula. Paula?
Hello.
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 Hi. You got to turn your radio off, Paula. All right. Have a good one. Terry in Riverside. Terry.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
Hi. I have a few ideas on the slogan war. Obama should come up with some just hard-hitting slogans like, if Obama wins, you win Social Security. If they win, you win $5,000 vouchers. Back Obama and back your government. Back them and back super rich corporations. And also, the main thing that I have for a long time is these voting machines.
Yes.
They've been proven, and they're run by right-wing, you know, brothers, and they keep changing their names. I'm sure, you know, the big corporations don't want to lose their hold.
Well,
you know, the Republicans,
Terry,
are on a
you want to know how
they have to secure them.
Terry, you want to know how we can make it so that voting machines don't matter? We can win elections handily, and that means that we have to work harder. And as far as slogans go, I think President Obama should just use McCain's slogan from the last time around, the American president that Americans have been waiting for in America. You want to drive the right wingers crazy. If you think the Clint Eastwood ad during the Super Bowl made Republican heads explode, if Obama ran on that slogan, I think their heads would explode from the neck up. Let's take Deborah in Oregon. Deborah.
Hello, Carl.
Yes.
You know, I have been hearing so much in the news lately about the super PACs and how they're taking over and how they're buying up all the media and taking over our free speech.
Right.
It surprises me that no one has come up with the word responsibility. Responsibility, let the networks take responsibility for some of these ads.
Why would they do that when they're making millions and millions and billions of dollars?
But see, this is, you know, well, then what do we do? Give them free run? That's the
no,
problem.
We don't. We need a president, and we need a Congress that will fight for a constitutional amendment that overturns Citizens United. Elections have consequences, and when George Bush was elected and reelected, he got to pick a Supreme Court that was decidedly corporatist. And if you think that this is a problem, this is why you need to work your tail off to get make sure that Mitt Romney's not elected, because the entire Supreme Court will end up the way that Bush left it to us, and it will get worse long before it ever gets better. There is no simple solution to this problem, but corporations are not going to stop these ads from going on television because they're going to take the money. And just remember, last election, Fox News, News Corp, gave money, direct corporate contributions to the Republican Governors Association and other entities. They are not even shy about taking advantage of Citizens United. So if you want this to stop, you've got to get off your tail. You've got to get out there. You've got to educate people. You've got to vote and make sure everybody you know votes the right way. Otherwise, it's just going to get worse. Let's take Joyce in Pennsylvania. Joyce.
Carl.
Yes.
I just want to ask you if you agree with me that I think that there are Democrats that are secretly working against the president. I feel that. I heard the guy on Tom's show, I believe he was on, I don't know if it was Monday or last week, he was talking about the Democrats that were working against him. Do you agree with that or no? And I'll take my answer off the air. And
all right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joyce. I'm sure there are some Democrats working against the president. But I don't think that there's a movement that's grown to work against the president within his own party. And I don't think they've done an effective job of undermining him. I think it's important that progressives as a whole hold the president accountable when he hedges on an issue or when he compromises with Republicans, because that helps strengthen progressives and Democratic ideals, and it makes it easier for the president to get his job done in a way that we like it. Look, if we go home and pack it up, there's not going to be any incentive for him to stay true to what he campaigned on. And it's going to be harder for him to do that. We need to create the public space so that he can get the things done that we elected him to get done. And that means sending him a Democratic Congress in November as well. Otherwise, it's only going to get worse. If you think it was bad under Bush, imagine a President Romney with a Republican Congress. It would not be pretty. This is the Tom Hartman Program. It is just 4 before the top of the hour. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter. As I said earlier in the show, I'm trying to get to 10,000 followers by my 30th birthday. And at this point, shameless plugs are sounding pretty desperate. So I hope you'll follow me as a little birthday treat to myself. When we come back, we'll talk about super PACs and more and the Prop 8 decision. We'll be back after this.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. Find me on Facebook. Follow me on YouTube. Hit me up on Friendster. Any social network that's ever existed, you can find me on, even ones that don't exist anymore. It's been a big day of news. We've got Colorado and Minnesota tonight, and Prop 8 has been ruled unconstitutional by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. But the biggest news today, coming out of last night, is the fact that President Obama appears to have backed down and has decided that he's not going to unilaterally disarm and allow Mitt Romney and the right-wing, you know, oil baron super PACs to run roughshod over the 2012 elections. He's going to encourage folks, apparently, to give money to a group of super PACs that are aligned with Democrats and progressive values. Joining me to talk about that issue is Lee Fang. He is a reporter at republicreport.org. Lee, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Carl. How's it going?
Good, thanks. So this is big news. Up until now, the president and his team have been very standoffish when it comes to these super PACs, haven't they?
Yes, even in 2007, 2008, President Obama in debates and on the campaign stump over and over again promised he wouldn't use these outside groups. Back then, they were known as 527s.
And this is before Citizens United.
Yeah, before Citizens United, he explicitly eschewed these types of groups because he said they have a corrupting influence on the process and that, you know, these types of entities lead to scandals, lead to the type of legalized bribery that we've seen in Washington for so long. And this reversal is a big deal.
What kind of an impact do you think it's going to have on the race? I mean, I was watching, I think it was either Tom's program on RT or the Young Turks on Current, and they ran up the numbers of what's being spent here. And thus far on the right, it's upwards of $240 million that's been pumped into these conservative super PACs, whether it's Romney, Newt, whoever. And on the left, if you take everything into consideration, including what Obama's raised, which is over $100 million already, it comes up to like $140 million. It's barely a drop in the bucket compared to the right. Do you think it's going to open up the coffers of liberal-minded donors?
I think that's yet to be seen. I think he'll certainly be able to raise more from corporations because they can give unlimited amounts to these super PACs that Obama's enabling. But the sad thing about campaign finance stories, if you go on Google News or you read the newspaper for the last 4 months, you read all these crazy stories about how much these super PACs are raising. Unfortunately, none of these stories matter because certain types of groups called 501c4s and 501c6s can raise unlimited amounts and never tell the public or the media how much they're raising. So Karl Rove could say that he raises $50 million for his super PAC, but in reality, he's got $500 million in his C4. I'm just making these numbers up because no one knows, and we won't know for the duration of the election.
And are we just going to pretend like this is the way things always are, or is there? Do you think this could actually lead to some kind of real campaign finance reform?
Well, look, the media, I think, has dropped the ball, the mainstream media. I mean, Matt Lauer interviewed Obama on Sunday night before the Super Bowl and asked him about this issue, and Obama said, you know, he's worried about the super PACs, but he suggested that, you know, his hands are tied because of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. That's not true, and Matt Lauer never called him out on that.
Well, what could the president do?
He could snap his fingers right now and issue an executive order that forces government contractors to disclose every penny of campaign disclosures. And that means that's basically every major corporation in America. Because if you're in a Fortune 500 company, you basically at least have one tiny contract with the government. That's everyone from the big oil companies, Coke Industries, a lot of big manufacturing companies. Just go down the list. It's really everyone. So he could do that right now, but I challenge you to look into the mainstream media.
Sure.
And see how many people are actually bringing this topic
well,
up.
Well, it's startling. It's startling, too, because campaign finance reform is usually one of those issues that the media loves to glom onto. I mean, if you think of John McCain's career, the reason that everybody knows who he is today and the reason he was the nominee for the Republicans in 2008 is because the media took a liking to him around campaign finance reform. They see it as one of those issues that really shows that you have a flinty-minded spirit.
The broadcasters want the ad revenues. I mean, they're part of this as well. The broadcaster
sure.
lobby actually helped support Citizens United. Why? Because they want more ad spending.
Right. Well, you know, and ultimately, I guess what this comes down to is how long it would take to actually enact anything. Because, you know, the second a Republican president gets in the White House, if Obama were to issue such an executive order that you just prescribed, it'd be gone. I mean, they would get rid of it in a heartbeat because it would, you know, make it easier for them to hold on to power. Looking at 2000, you know, when McCain ran for president in 2000 against George Bush, largely on campaign finance reform, he'd been an advocate for it for a number of years. But the interesting thing was that in the 1990s, or the late 1980s, when George H.W. Bush was president, Democrats in the Senate, along with a lot of Republicans in the Senate, and a bipartisan coalition in the House passed a robust campaign finance reform initiative, far more sweeping than McCain-Feingold ever was. And George H.W. Bush vetoed it. And then when Clinton took office, they tried to do the same thing, but the Republicans who had voted for it and pushed it over that 60-vote mark in the Senate decided that they weren't going to support it this time around. And then it took another 8 years before McCain-Feingold ever saw the light of day and got watered down before it was signed into law. So even if we're looking
right.
at real campaign finance reform, aren't we talking about another decade of just horrible, horrible, you know, inaction on the issue?
Well, I'd like to look back on the 1936 election. You know, when FDR was finishing his very first term, he faced an unprecedented flood of corporate money, the likes of which had never been seen before in American history. And you know what he did? He knew he couldn't compete. Unlike Obama, he didn't say, okay, let me try to go ask J.P. Morgan and DuPont for some money and see if I can compete. Instead, he had his allies in the Senate, Senator Hugo Black from Alabama, investigate the bastards. They issued subpoenaed. They read telegrams on the floor of Congress, and they ripped all these front groups to shreds and showed that the Republican nominee, Alf Landon, was really just a puppet of all of these big business barons and these companies that really helped destroy the country a few years prior in the Great Depression.
But do you think something like that could actually have an impact this time around? Because don't you think the average American is just going to say, well, both parties are bought off and paid for? I'm not surprised by any of this news.
That's the problem that Obama's inviting by bringing in corporate money on his side. He's basically negating the one distinguishing factor between him and Romney in terms of these kind of structural issues. I predict that by the end of this year, before the election, there will be major scandals involved with this super PACs in terms of influence peddling and lobbyists. And before yesterday, these scandals would have only come down on the Romney and pro-Republican side pretty much. Now that Obama is inviting the secret money, this big money, this corporate money into his side, he's going to bring himself down with it.
Well, what can people do about this? I mean, obviously, I'm torn because I do believe that we shouldn't unilaterally disarm on the left and watch as Republicans and conservatives spend untold amounts of money in this election, and the president can only spend what he's raised, and then obviously there's some liberal groups that will spend money too, but the Sierra Club doesn't exactly have the money that the Chamber of Commerce has. If you can stick around for another segment, I'd love to chat with you about what the solution might be.
That sounds great, Carl.
All right. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Lee Fang about Citizens United and the president's decision to allow his allies to raise the unlimited money that these right-wing super PACs have been raising. It's disconcerting to many, especially those who have been fighting for campaign finance reform or who have been watching Citizens United. I'm torn. I don't want to disarm unilaterally, but I also want campaign finance reform. We'll take your calls after this, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. We're talking to Lee Fang from republicreport.org. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about this and other issues. We'll be back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, more with Lee Fong from RepublicReport.org. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frazier. We're talking about the super PAC bonanza that's about to get started here in Washington. We're talking to Lee Fong. He's a reporter for RepublicReport.org. Lee, thanks for sticking around with us as we delve a little bit deeper into this.
Thanks for having me.
So you heard the caller, I presume, saying that, you know, you're living in la-la land. I don't think you're living in la-la land. I think you're raising some very justifiable concerns. But doesn't it get harder to turn back from these steps once we've taken them?
It becomes very difficult to move back. Just think, you know, I did a story about a month ago that showed that the WPP Group, this big multinational conglomerate that owns a lot of the ad firms and the lobbying firms that are going to be participating this year in the election, they're hoping for a $6 billion payday just from the race. And you have to think about how that's sorted out. Yes, Obama might be able to raise $1 billion, even from small donors, which would be amazing. He might be able to raise another $500 million from corporate donors. But do you really think he can compete? Even on this, if he's using the exact same rules that Karl Rove is using in the big money game. And the sad fact of the matter is, back in 2008, a lot of the big corporations that organized their employees to support Obama, that was in Wall Street, that was in healthcare, that was in energy, that's because they were afraid of regulation. They were afraid of reform. they thought if they bought into the Obama campaign, they could at least blunt some of the more pro-consumer, pro-public policies. This time around, it's different. It's a different ballgame. These big industries, particularly Wall Street and the healthcare sector, they want to roll back the few regulations that were passed, so they have no incentive to donate to Obama. So you add in Citizens United, you add in the super organized Koch network, you add in the highly partisan chamber, then you add in the lack of an incentive for these business groups to donate to Obama. Even if he competes using Karl Rove's rules, he's going to be swamped. So he has to use a different strategy, not the same Karl Rove strategy.
Well, I mean, okay, then the question becomes, let's say he's reelected. These groups are not going to go away overnight. And frankly, I don't think a lot of them would be frightened of disclosing how much money they're spending on politics. So what does he do? If he's got a Republican House of Representatives, perhaps a Republican Senate, it's not going to get any better.
Well, look, the feds thought it was important to go after Blagojevich, and they tapped his phones and investigated, because public corruption is corrosive. It's a cancer to our democracy. If we don't have integrity in our elections and in our public officials, we don't really have a functioning society, and it hurts our economy as well. So Obama should do this right now. He shouldn't do, if he's elected in 2013, he should right now appoint a group of investigators from the DOJ to look into government corruption on the federal level. This already happens on the state and local level. Incredibly, they devote a great deal of resources, but they don't on the federal level. He should do that. He should issue his executive order that discloses the money, because this election is already awash in secret money. And those are concrete steps that he can take right now, since not only just clean up our elections, but I think that would inspire the American people to be more, to participate more this year.
Well, I certainly hope so. One of the things that you report on republicreport.org, which is a great resource if anybody wants to check that out, they should. You've got a piece up from this morning talking about how a bunch of Wall Street consultants are complaining about the Stock Act, saying that the transparency proposal will hurt middle-class Americans. What kind of ridiculousness do these people live in?
Well, it's we've seen this kind of, kind of ridiculous rhetoric of people realizing that the Stock Act, as it's being amended, some of the strong parts were taken out, but they actually, Senator Grassley added a strong provision in that adds lobbying disclosure for what's known as political intelligence firms. Wall Street banks, basically, and hedge funds, they hire this special class of lobbyists to get inside tips so they can make investment advice. Grassley added an amendment to the Stock Act, this measure to prohibit insider trading in Congress, to make these political intelligence firms register, just like a normal lobbying firm. It's just a transparency measure. But these consultants are freaking out. They're saying that these measures will hurt the American people, will hurt middle-class Americans. I mean, we're seeing
middle-class Americans like Mitt Romney's middle-class American, right?
Exactly. You know, Tom Coburn, the senator from Oklahoma, I believe, he was on the floor last week saying that, you know, he doesn't want this Stock Act to pass because he, quote, honestly believes that no one in Congress would ever use insider trading. I mean, they're trying all the rhetorical tricks in the book, but the Stock Act and the measure to increase transparency with these political intelligence firms, they're practical. It's just basically a little bit of sunlight.
Is there any way to determine, I know there was that initial report, exactly how much money these members of Congress are making off of the knowledge they have from being members of Congress?
It's very difficult. You know, we're coming out with a slew of these stories this week, so please check back, and thank you for plugging republicreport.org. But the ways congressmen enrich themselves is very complicated, and they obviously try to hide it, because sometimes they don't send it directly to themselves. They don't make, you know, investments in using earmarks or stock. Sometimes they get their family members inside companies so they can be on the take that way. Sometimes they set up shell institutes and corporations that can receive money. It's very complicated, because obviously no politician wants to be caught up with this kind of thing and get humiliated and lose their seat. At the same time, they see a huge potential to make millions.
Well, and in the words of Mitt Romney, a blind trust is just a ruse. It's an age-old ruse.
That is a great point, because as we're contacting some of these members of Congress, we're coming out with some exclusive stories this week. They're all telling us, oh, don't worry about any of our investments. They're managed by a third party, even though, you know, this third party is investing in things that the congressman oversees on a subcommittee, you know.
It's fascinating. Lee Fong, he's a reporter with republicreport.org. You can go to their website, sign up, and get more from them. Follow Lee on Twitter. Twitter at LH Fong. That's F-A-N-G. So you can keep up to date on his work. This is the Tom Hartman Program, and we'll be back after this with a discussion about Prop 8.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, exclusive details about the Prop 8 decision in California. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom in this last half hour. I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. Go there, sign up for my email updates, and follow me on Twitter and Facebook at Carl Frisch. It's been a great afternoon chatting with all of you. Let's take Pat in Arkansas. Hello, Pat.
Hello.
Yes.
This is Pat from Arkansas, not Paula.
Yes.
And my TV is turned off. I had called in previously about the voting, the two-party.
Yes.
And you're backing Obama.
Okay.
Well, I'm an elderly lady, and I've been voting for a long, long time.
Okay.
And I stopped voting for the worser of two evils years ago. And the problem is you have a two-party system.
Well, let me ask you a question. Are you more liberal?
Do not interrupt me. If you have a two-party system and you're upset with them and you think they're both the same, if you continue to only vote for two parties, that's all you will ever have.
Well, let me ask you a question, Pat. Are you displeased because you think Democrats aren't Democratic enough or Republicans aren't Republican enough?
Well, I go back. I'm not this latest voting. I go back many years.
To the Whigs?
And I have been displeased with our government system for quite a few years.
Okay.
As I said, I stopped voting.
Well, I heard you. I'm curious. I'm curious.
Let me continue.
Ma'am, I heard you say it the first time. I'm curious if you stopped voting Republican and Democrat because either the party you used to vote in wasn't conservative enough or was it not liberal enough?
Neither one of those. They were both crooked.
Okay.
It was whether which one was crooked enough. Would you let me continue?
Actually, we have a guest waiting on hold. I'm glad we got you back on the phone after we weren't able to chat with you before. But, you know, I think it's important that people know that when they vote for third parties, and this is my opinion, obviously, they risk making things worse than the thing that got them to vote in the third party. Beside the point, today's a very good day. For the people of California, and frankly for the people of this country, the Ninth Circuit Court out in California has ruled that Proposition 8, which made it illegal for LGBT people to be married, it outlawed marriage equality in California's Constitution, has been ruled unconstitutional. Joining me to talk about this and to fill us on exactly what the decision says is Christopher Geithner. He is the senior political editor of Metro Weekly, which you can find at metroweekly.com. And you can follow Chris on Twitter at Chris Geithner, G-E-I-D-N-E-R. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Carl.
Hello. So,
how are you doing?
I'm very happy. My home state of California, it looks like things are getting better. Obviously, this probably has to go to the Supreme Court from here. But why don't you fill everybody in on exactly what the ruling says and perhaps what that says about the case?
Well, today the Ninth Circuit ruled on the appeal of the August 2010 decision from then Judge Vaughn Walker that California's 2008 amendment, Proposition 8, was unconstitutional. And the opinion, which was a 2-1 opinion, there was one judge who dissented, Judge Randy Smith. But Judge Stephen Reinhardt, who wrote the opinion, said that the amendment violates the U.S. Constitution. But what he did, what the court decided was that it violated the Constitution not on the broad grounds that Judge Walker had decided, but on narrow grounds that basically related to an earlier case in Colorado that came out of Colorado by the U.S. Supreme Court, Romer versus
Romer,
Evans.
Right. Well, let me ask you a question about that.
Yeah.
When Romer was found unconstitutional, did it have an impact outside of Colorado?
Well, it didn't directly have an impact outside of Colorado, and that's the potential impact here, is that by deciding that in California, because the California Supreme Court had found that California's constitution required marriage equality, and then the voters in 2008 took that away, that was a unique situation, and that doesn't really apply to any other states thus far. And so because of that, the ruling, by deciding today that on what I've been calling Romer grounds, that California's Proposition 8 is unconstitutional, it even if that opinion were to be affirmed by the Supreme Court, it wouldn't have an immediate impact on any other state marriage law.
Couldn't it have an impact on Hawaii, and if Iowa gets rid of marriage, or if...
No, because, well, it could, yes. I mean, and that's the thing, all of these, and then there would be an argument about Maine. There would be an argument if in Washington this year they pass it and it faces a referendum. But in California, there is a technical difference, which was that there were actually marriages happening. That the referendum process, for example, in Washington is a part of the system.
Right.
And so it wouldn't be taking away a right. It would be having impacted a referendum. Now you could argue and you could take it to court and use this ruling to try and build on it to say that, well, this is slightly different than what happened in California, but the same logic applies. And that's probably what people would do. But the ruling today itself is very narrow.
So of the things that could have happened, either they could have agreed with the response saying that it wasn't unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
They could have had a sweeping decision that upheld Walker and basically said that there's no reason to discriminate against gay people in any way, shape, or form. And they chose the middle ground.
They chose the middle ground. They chose a narrow opinion that in theory, I mean, one of the reasons why I've always thought that this would be a potential route to take is that this places, because of the fact that it doesn't impact any other state immediately, even within the Ninth Circuit, the Western states, the Supreme Court could say, well, if and when the case is appealed to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court could say, we're not going to take this case. We'll let it stand because this doesn't have any impact outside of this state itself. So we can let this percolate and see what happens as a result of that rather than needing to address this case immediately.
Well, and for folks listening at home, what does it take for a case to be picked up by the Supreme Court?
Well, what's going to happen now is that the proponents of Proposition 8, the people who put Prop 8 on the ballot, are going to decide what they want to do, whether or not they want to do what's called ask for en banc review, which is asking for the entire Ninth Circuit to hear the case, or whether or not they'll go directly to the Supreme Court and ask the Supreme Court to hear the case.
Now, if the entire Ninth Circuit hears the case, could they potentially do a more sweeping decision than the initial Ninth Circuit panel?
Yes, they could. I mean, they could reverse the Ninth Circuit's, the panel's decision today. They could say that Prop 8 is upheld. They could say that it's struck down on broad grounds, or they could basically say we think the three-judge panel is right. But if that happens, or if the proponents want to go directly to the Supreme Court, what they would do, it's called seeking certiorari. And they will file what's called a cert petition and ask the court to hear the case. And four of the nine justices need to agree to hear the case in order for the Supreme Court to take it.
Okay. I'm interested. Does Walker's initial ruling from August in 2010, does that now go away? I mean, does it serve as precedent in any way now, or is it kind of usurped by the Ninth Circuit?
It serves as historical record, not as court precedent. The Ninth Circuit opinion is that they're the superior court. They're the appeals court for the Northern District of California, where Judge Walker sat, and so their opinion supersedes his opinion.
One thing I was thinking is, if you know, we saw this with the decision that came out the other day, if a more sweeping decision had made its way to the Supreme Court, and there was fear among the conservative justices that Kennedy would back it, was the idea that Roberts would back it as well, so that he could assert his privilege to write the opinion and make it more refined.
The Judge Reinhardt's opinion, I mean, basically says that this is the most narrow way that we can resolve this case. And that's a principle called constitutional avoidance, which basically, as a judge, you should try and decide a case on the most narrow grounds you can to avoid bigger questions. And by doing that,
I want to finish this part up in the next segment, if you can stick around. This is the Tom Hartman program. We're talking about the Prop 8 decision and what happened and what happens next. And we'll be back after this.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Closing time. Open all the doors and let you out into the world.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman program, filling in for Tom, who is homesick. And we wish him well and tell him to get better. Go tweet your well wishes to him. Go post him on Facebook. We're rooting for you to get better so you can be back in this chair tomorrow, Tom. I'm Carl Frisch, filling in for a sick but getting better, Tom Hartman will say. This is the Tom Hartman program, and we've been chatting a little bit about the Prop 8 decision, which has been defined narrowly by the Ninth Circuit, basically saying that Proposition 8 was unconstitutional for California, but kind of limiting it to that. We're talking to Chris Geidner from Metro Weekly. He's the senior political editor there. You can follow him at metroweekly.com or on Twitter, Chris Geidner. Chris, thanks for sticking around.
No problem.
So obviously we're probably minutes away from a flurry of press releases from the presidential candidates. Do you think this helps the president evolve on marriage?
I don't know. I mean, I've written about the fact that I think that this does provide a great opportunity for the president to finish evolving. I think that the position that the president has taken over almost a year ago, on February 23rd of last year.
I don't think anybody thought when he said he was evolving that it would actually be in real time.
Darwin would be impressed.
Right.
Or not. The decision last year by Obama and the Department of Justice to stop defending the Defense of Marriage Act in court, and the filings that they've made in court cases in the months since then, suggest that there's no way on the legal grounds that the administration could have any position other than thinking that Proposition 8 is unconstitutional, even on the broad grounds that Judge Walker had held it unconstitutional. And so I think it would be an opportunity for the president to say, I think that what the Ninth Circuit did is right. As I've often stated, I think that these divisive measures are bad, and we should let Californian same-sex couples continue the right established by the California Supreme Court years ago and marry.
But you don't think he's going to take that extra step?
I think it would be a
unusual,
surprising step.
Yeah. What about the Republicans? I mean, you've got Rick Santorum, who talks about gay people more than I do, and I'm a gay man. Do you think he's going to make hay of this tonight, or is he just going to wait to win Minnesota and call it a night?
I mean, I don't know. I think Rick Santorum, I think you'd see something from. I think Newt Gingrich already put out a tweet about it. I think we want to see what Mitt Romney has to say about it.
I'm sure he'll have many things to say. They won't necessarily agree with what the previous statement was. But Chris Geithner, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And really, he's a top-notch reporter on these and many other issues. Go follow him at metroweekly.com. Read his blog at Polyglot there. And follow him on Twitter. He's prolific. Chris Geithner, Geidner. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thank you, Carl.
All right. So it's hard to contain my disappointment with this, you know, more refined decision. I was really hoping for something sweeping. But then again, I think that's what flies in the face of my pragmatism. I mean, I often think that activism for activism's sake without a likelihood for success or even improvement is difficult because it just feel-good activism makes you feel good, but it doesn't necessarily move the ball down the court. And this is maybe one of those moments where the pragmatic thing is to get a victory here for Californians. But I guess we're going to have to wait and see. Best case scenario, this thing goes to the Supreme Court after the Ninth Circuit kind of opens it up again. But that sounds pretty difficult, if you ask me. It's been a long 3 years since Proposition 8 passed, and no doubt we haven't heard the end of it yet, and we'll keep an eye on those proponents. Let's talk to Dane in Oregon. Dane.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I want to first say that you're doing an excellent job as a replacement for Tom today.
Thank you.
And my main point was that there is a way, I think, to reach the uninformed voters, and that is simply that there are too many talk hosts that wind up denigrating the other side and calling them names and turning off the middle ground people who don't do a lot of listening and being involved in politics. And when they do, they hear stuff that really turns them off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of hosts that, you know, need to have that brought to them. And I would like to challenge the listeners to do that more to a lot of these hosts, because I think we can bring in a lot more conversation. You know, if we stop calling John Boehner John Boner and Rush Limbaugh, limp balls, and other stupid stuff.
Let me put this in a little bit of.
It doesn't improve the conversation.
I have no doubt in my head that some people don't like that. I have no doubt in my head that a lot of people do like it. But I will also tell you this: when we talk about the audience of people consuming this type of media, whether it's conservative talk radio, progressive talk radio, Fox News, MSNBC, look at Fox News as an example. A good night for Bill O'Reilly is like 2 million viewers. That's out of 360 million people. Certainly, 358 million people are not watching Bill O'Reilly because of the coarseness of his dialogue. People are living day to day, and they need more help from their government. They spend time worrying about putting food on the table and providing for their family. It's not just about the political dialogue that we have, and I think sometimes being colorful and humorous can add to that. And certainly, if the left doesn't do it, the right's going to continue doing it. So I respectfully disagree, but you know, I think we can do that and still be friends. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom's been out sick today. We're hoping he's back tomorrow. I'm Carl Frisch. I've been filling in, and I hope you'll join me at carlfrisch.com and follow me on Twitter. I want to thank Jacob and everybody in the Hartman team for making this a breeze for me today. It's been a delight to guest for Tom, and I look forward to doing it again sometime. Until then, the Tom Hartman Program is off until tomorrow.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.